Yeah, the standing up before I started was a little much, but just take it easy. I start to believe my own press. Let's just take a moment to invite God into the meeting. Father God, we thank you for this time tonight, Lord, and we ask you just to keep our minds open, our hearts open. Help us to hear the message, your message, and so thank you so much for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We thank you so much for giving us this place and this 12-step house and places like this where people like us are welcomed and they clap for us. It's all in your name. We pray. Amen. Amen. Hi, everybody. My name is Stevie B, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. Yay! And I'm a proud member of the West Side Men's Group. Nice! Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Well, I want to thank the Fort Lauderdale 12-step groups for asking me to speak. And thank you for asking me to speak tonight. And it's just an honor and a privilege to be here. And I had all these great stories that I was going to tell, but my first sponsor and my second sponsor happened to be sitting in the room at the exact same time. So that's it. I just got to stick to the book. I had all these great stories, but then Myron walked in, and then I was like, well, at least Russell won't be here for the second half. And he's here, so we'll keep it to the facts tonight. What a blessing tonight is. Let me just tell you a little bit about myself, and I'm going to go to my first day of my horrific relapse before I go into everything else. My wife decided she was going to go out of the country. I had just had 6 years of continuous sobriety. I hadn't had a drink in 6 years. And I started doing things inside the house, which I'll tell you about for the next 12 weeks or the next 11 weeks. If you come here, I'll start telling you about a little of the extracurricular activities I was doing while I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of the people inside this room, like Wendy and Myron, were privileged to that, and you guys saw what was happening, my demise, and I didn't see it. Because what I found out about alcoholism is you will be the last to know. Yeah. You'll be the last to know. I thought my program was rock solid. I thought I had this thing. I felt really confident. I would even take in a statement saying that I will always be sober. As a matter of fact, drinking was the farthest thing from my mind. If you had asked me in any meeting that I was going to, did I ever think about drinking, I'd say it's the farthest thing from my mind. Now, I want to tell you over the next 12 weeks, when we speak about drinking, you have to understand when I say drinking, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, but I want you to fill in the blanks when I say drinking. Obviously, if I tell you I spent $1,000 the night before, you understand what type of drinking I'm talking about. If I tell you that I was looking outside the window in a little closet that I built underneath the stairs for a month, you understand what type of drinking I'm talking about. So there's a lot of drinking going on in my life. Some small shots and some in tall glasses, but there's a lot of drinking. So if you would have asked me in my 6th year or my 5th year of sobriety if I was thinking about drinking, I'd say absolutely not. But if you would have asked me, do you think you're an alcoholic? Do you really think you're an alcoholic? And if I was honest with you in my 5th year of sobriety, I would have said, no, I don't. Because I knew I had a horrible problem with drugs. The information was obvious. Where I was living in the streets of New York and underneath stairs and all that nonsense was... It's obvious I had a horrific drug problem. But I had never thought, and even if when I did my first step, I never thought that I had an alcohol problem. So being an Alcoholics Anonymous and introducing yourself as an alcoholic for 5 years under Myron, my sponsor in the 11-step group in the back room over here, and introducing myself as an alcoholic, I really was introducing myself as an alcoholic so that I would fit in with you guys, but I never felt like I was an alcoholic. I always felt like I was a drug addict, but I liked Alcoholics Anonymous better, so I just said alcoholic. Now, what we're going to talk about in the first step tonight is that's a very, very precarious place to be, or a dangerous place to be if you're inside a program that has to do with alcoholism and you don't think that you have alcoholism. There's only so long that game is going to go on. And in the first step, it talks about that nobody likes to admit complete defeat. Nobody likes to say, you know what? I was wrong. I am an alcoholic. I lost at this battle. Everyone likes to keep some cards hidden. Everyone likes to keep some cards hidden, like, yes, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes, but I don't really have a drinking problem. I have a drug problem. So the whole time I would come to meetings and Myron, and I would say, Myron, I'd like to introduce myself as an alcoholic and an addict. He says, that's not necessary. When you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, you introduce yourself as an alcoholic, and when you go to the other program, you can introduce yourself as an addict. And that worked for a while. But I already have bipolar disorder coming into the program, and to have two different titles in two different programs, it was definitely a little bit more than I can handle. So I really wanted to say I was an addict and an alcoholic. But it turns out really what I have is just run-of-the-mill, garden-variety alcoholism. It has nothing to do with the substance that I used, the quantities that I used it, or the places that I did. It has everything to do with what centers in my mind, and I really believe that today. You see, you can say I'm a cornaholic. If I knew that corn, in all of its shapes and forms, fried corn and corn on the cob and corn giblets and golden corn, if I knew that corn would get me to a certain place that would relieve me of my mental obsession, I would use corn. But instead, I found that different things work a little bit faster than corn, like alcohol. Now, in my fifth year of sobriety, I started to read these magazines. Cigar aficionado. I started to smoke cigars in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's kind of a thing that guys do. You know, my good friend out in Minnesota, he introduced me to cigar smoking. He said, this is what guys in the program do. We don't drink. We don't go to strip clubs. But we do smoke cigars. So I said, okay. And I started smoking cigars. Now, for the first 4 or 5 years that I smoked cigars, I really had to try to enjoy it. It was the most disgusting thing I ever did, but I wanted to fit in. And as I pushed myself through that learning curve, and I started to actually tolerate cigars and like cigars, I started reading this magazine called Cigar Aficionado. And everybody in Cigar Aficionado usually had a cigar and a cognac. Or a cigar and brandy. Or a cigar and something in some type of glass with rocks, with ice. And there was always a beautiful girl on the side of the room in a long, slinky dress by the piano in front of a mahogany bar. And somehow I had forgotten that when I was in Pennsylvania, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living under the stairs in a little room that I had built from a luggage closet. That I built this incredible security system that when I was in there, I built this wood piece that if you nail a nail in the middle and you turn the wood piece, it actually locks the door from the inside. It was a very high-tech security system. It was before Brinks. So somehow in the last 6 years of my sobriety, I had forgotten that I used to live under the stairs like Willard. And so when I started to read in Cigar Aficionado that these guys that were smoking cigars and there was always this beautiful girl on the side with this long slinky dress in front of a piano and mahogany bars, I started to see myself as one of those guys. Now, I want to tell you something that if you would have told me in my sixth year, are you thinking about drinking? I would have said, absolutely not. Are you sure, Steve, that you're not thinking about drinking? I said, absolutely not. But inside, in the inner workings of my mind, I did not think that I was powerless over alcohol in any way, shape, or form. And now that I had some time away from alcohol, I really didn't think I was powerless over it. As a matter of fact, powerless and alcohol were not in the same sentence for me. I had thought I had gained some power over a lot of substances other than drugs. Now, if you were saying to me, do you think you're a drug addict? I would say, yeah, of course, absolutely, I'm a drug addict. But what I didn't understand about the disease of alcoholism is that the disease of alcoholism never enters into the front door. The disease of alcoholism enters into the back door. It's never going to say to you, you know what, Steve, I think that you need to go smoke some, and you need to just do it, and you need to go there, and you need to, and it'll never say that to me. What it says to me is I think that you're a brandy, cognac, mahogany bar, leather attaché case, three-piece suit type of guy. Now, I want to tell you that I work at the Fort Lauderdale Swap Shop. I've never worn a three-piece suit at work in my entire life. As a matter of fact, I usually go in flip-flops and shorts. So the idea that I thought I was this three-piece suit guy that was going to be able to sip cognacs and smoke cigars, I don't know exactly where it came from. I had never even met a cognac yet. And I had never really drank brandy other than like in Coca-Cola. So I don't know where I came up with this thing. But in my fifth year of sobriety, I went into the 11-step group and I announced in front of Myron and LaDonna and everybody that I don't think that I have alcoholism. I don't want to drink and I don't want to do drugs, but I've really been fooling you guys. And they all talked to me. You know, I was 27 at the time, and they all talked to me. They come around me like I do with you, John. They came around me, and they said, "It's okay. We understand. You're going to go through this. It's peaks and valleys." And we all think that, you know, it's in the big book and says we all will drink again. And there's this guy, and he retired. He put on his slippers. And we all want to drink again, but we just don't one day at a time. And I didn't really like that answer. I wanted to really believe in my heart of hearts that I did fit into this program, because you can't admit complete defeat if you don't believe it. And what this tells us, what the first step tells us on the bottom in the 12 and 12, and let me say something, where's Kevin? In this step series, if you decide to come back and you don't own a 12 by 12 or 12 and 12, you need to get a 12 and 12. Now, we're not going to be talking from the 12 and 12 the entire time, because there's things in the 12 and 12 that, you know, I really truthfully don't. We're not going to be talking about the 12 and 12 the entire time. But you really do need to have a 12 and 12. You need to have a big book in Alcoholics Anonymous. These are the manuals of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, why not have the manuals? I mean, if I want to go to nursing school, I'm going to read the manuals. If I want to become a doctor, I'm going to read the manuals. If I want to, whatever it is, you're in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you need to have these two books. And as Kevin likes to quote that, I always say, if you don't have a 12 and 12, you're not really in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So get a 12 and 12. Because the first step in the 12 by 12 is rock solid. You see, they wrote the big book between 1935 and 1939, published in 1939. And they had all this great experience of just a couple years of sobriety, 3-4 years of sobriety. But then after being sober a while, 15 years, then they write to 12 and 12. That's good and bad. Good because there's a whole bunch of experience in here. Bad because they let a lot of humanness sneak into the 12 and 12. But not in the first step. Because on the bottom of the first step, it says that we know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he can first accept his devastating weaknesses. Now, I came in Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a horrific drug problem. And I like to drink sometimes. But I could never really accept the powerlessness. So when I first started taking the pills in my 6 year of sobriety, a doctor prescribed me some pills for my broken toe, and the first thing that I didn't do was tell my sponsor. And then I really started to think, you know what, I could probably have a drink. Now the reason I tell you all that and I start the story right there in that place is because I want you to know I was the last to know that I would be drinking again. The last to know. And I want to tell you guys something, Spike. I want to tell you guys something. You guys will be the last to know. The alcoholic is the last to know, Dave. It's the last to know. You are not going to get a memo that you are going to be the one to drink. And you know how you know that if you're not going to enough meetings, you might get that memo too late. Because you might drink. So I pick up my 7-year medallion. Myron just happens to be in the meeting tonight. I pick up my 7-year medallion. I thank the meeting and I feel good about myself. You know, I'm 30 years old. I have 7 years of sobriety. That's no joke. Sponsoring like 11 of the sickest guys you could possibly imagine on the face of the planet. All of which probably are doing time at this time right now. And I decide that that week I'm going to celebrate my 7-year medallion by drinking. Now, I want to taste, and I say this in no jest. I never thought that by taking one drink that that would ever do anything to actually jeopardize my sobriety. Listen to that statement. You have to understand, listen to that statement. You understand why I say that the disease centers in our mind? I never thought that taking a drink would jeopardize my sobriety. I just thought it was like taking a drink, like going to the movies. I actually wanted to go to the movies. So I order Chinese food and I order a Japanese rice wine. I mean, seemed like a perfect mix. And I order that and I take that little shot of Japanese rice wine. 240 pounds at the time. The shot was like the size of a thimble. I thought it was just a nice accompaniment to Kung Pao chicken, exactly. I think that's what I had, actually. Or probably Happy Family. I was always into the Happy Family at that time. I drink my little rice wine and my Happy Family. And this is what happened to me. I'm not going to tell you that my whole program disintegrated and I fell out of society and I was living on the Broward Bridge. I'm not going to tell you that. But it was like one moment I was in the program and the next moment I was out. Everything in the one moment, I believed what you guys are saying. I believed in the 12 steps. I believed in the meetings. I believed in all of this. And then I didn't. As a matter of fact, one moment I was in, and the next moment I thought all of you were just whacked. Whacked. And I thought to myself, and this is the truth, I thought to myself, it's so sad that those guys actually have to go to meetings. You know what I'm saying? I want to go to meetings. I mean, I'm going to drink, and I'm going to go to meetings, but I go to meetings because I like the fellowship. And then preceded my going to meetings and drinking and feeling sorry for the rest of you because you couldn't drink while you went to meetings. And then I would have little discussions with Wendy, and when I started to take more pills, and I would say, Wendy, you know, I had to take these pills for my anxiety. And how do you come off, you know, 8 Xanny bars? And I started to have those type, you know, those type of conversations. Because we have this amazing, not only do we have amazing forgetter, but we also have this amazing capacity of warpness where it doesn't even seem out of the ordinary. You know, I didn't have a drug in my system for 7 years, and now I'm taking 70 Xanny bars a day, and I'm thinking that it's fine. And they were prescribed. Not in that quantity, of course. That was the entire bottle. But they were prescribed. I mean, the drug was prescribed, not that quantity. So technically, you know, I was probably not doing the right thing. So the reason that today is so special for me is because during that period of time, while my wife was calling Myron and saying, what should we do? And I was locking the lock from the inside by putting the key in the door and breaking off the key. Turns out that my sponsor was a locksmith. That's not always the best move when your sponsor's a locksmith. But anyway, it was temporary 24-hour type of deals where I would take the key and I would break it inside the lock. I know nobody in this room would ever do that. And then I would go inside the house and then the people couldn't get in, like my wife. And I'd say, oh, I don't know how that happened, you know. But during that time, our relationship got so bad, and she started to get so confused because she didn't know I had relapsed into drugs. I told her I was socially drinking. And she had set up some ground rules in the house of where I could only drink on Saturdays. And I said that would be fine. I would only drink in the house on Saturdays. But that leaves a lot of days in between Saturdays where you have to hide your booze. You get one day, you don't have to hide your booze, but you have... You know, 6 other days you have to hide your booze. And that could get really, really hectic, especially in a house our size and about the amount that I was drinking and drugging. So she just couldn't take it anymore, and she said she needed to go back to her home country of Colombia, which she hadn't been to in about 8 years. And on my way to the airport, I was telling myself, I'm not going to relapse into my drug of choice. I'm not going to relapse into my drug of choice. I'm not going to relapse into my drug of choice. And the whole way down there, knowing that as soon as that plane took off... that it was going to be on. Now, I don't know if you've ever done that with yourself. You're telling yourself, this is not going to happen. I'm certainly not going to do this type of behavior. I'm going to fly straight. I'm going to be okay. And the whole time knowing you're going to do the behavior. I know that goes on in your life. That even goes on in my life till today. You know, I said that, you know, this specific behavior that I know that blocks me away from the love of God, I'm not going to do it anymore. Knowing full well that I'm on my way to do it. It's kind of like I'm having a conversation with myself about what I know I'm going to do, but if I talk myself out of it, it's not so bad. Because I'm still doing it, but I'm actually talking myself out of it. At least I'm putting up a fight with myself. So I'm not going willingly into the sin. I'm saying, you know what, I don't want to do it. I know you're going to do it, but I know you don't want to do it, so that's at least half. It's not like you were actually giving in all the way. So I'm driving to the airport, and I'm saying to myself, I have 3 weeks, and I know that I'm not going to relapse into some of the harder alcohols and different things. I know you're not going to do that. So what you need to do when your wife's away is you just need to maintain. And at the same time, I know that as soon as that plane gets into the air, it's on. And it's Miami Airport. I mean, I'm already in the air. Not like I got to make a local, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm already there. Hey, Tony. So... I'm on the way back from the airport, and I just know, you know, and it's at that time in the morning when the planes to Colombia left at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's at that perfect time when the phone's not ringing yet because no one's up, but it's sunny almost, and it's not a lot of cars. You got that peace and serenity, and you know about the terrible things about to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. You haven't tried that specific thing in a long time. For myself, it was 7 years. And I was thinking to myself, you know what? Maybe it wasn't so bad after all. And I kind of talked myself into it, saying, you know what? I'm in a different person. I'm in a different place in my life. The last time that thing that happened to me like that, I was only 25. Now I'm 31. You know, I own a house, a business, I'm married. I'm a man now. I would should be able to just use different types of things and then it should be fine. And I told myself that lie and I proceeded on my way and then started a downslide, immediate. Well, you know how it is. If you're here visiting and you're not an alcoholic, then you don't understand exactly what I'm talking about, but maybe you've seen TV shows or stuff, and if you're an alcoholic, you know exactly what I'm saying. I don't have to describe it. It's that incomprehensible demoralization that only an alcoholic knows, because you say you're not going to do it and you do it. You say that this time's going to be different and it's not. You wake up in the morning, you say, I'm not going to use today, and you do. By the end of the day, you're so morally bankrupt, you're so physically destroyed inside, you're so spiritually empty that you want to kill yourself, but you don't have the guts to do it. And thank God we don't, because it would be a permanent, solution to most of us in here to a temporary problem. So thank God we don't take our lives, but we come that close, don't we? We come that close. We want to just see how much the human resistance is there. And I drive to a place that I didn't even know existed, but my car must have, because it went right down to the place. Now, my car was only owned by me. I got it at Ford. I drove it off the Ford dealership. Never purchased alcohol off the streets, but somehow my car knew where to go. And on my way back from that airport, and I always said this to my wife, if it ever got really bad and I couldn't stop the addiction, I would come right back. You know, that's not the way addiction works. That's not what the rapacious creditor is all about. You know what it says in here? Listen to this. You're going to love this. Well, it says rapacious creditor in here, and it's good. You know what rapacious creditor means? It means a creditor with teeth like this that keeps clawing at you and calling you and never stops. You see, addiction is not something that just latches onto you and then you say, you know what, I had enough. It says, okay, uncle. Once you let that out of the bag, in my case, once you let that disease out of the bag, it didn't want to let me go. And the reason that today is so amazing for me is I drove my wife to the airport this morning at the same time. Same exact time of the month, leaving the airport, the sun was coming out, but now I haven't had a drink in my system for 9 years next month. And I want to tell you something. Praise God. It is incredible. It is incredible. It's incredible that what I've been through, and I'm going to share that with you, what I've been through, that I'm here tonight. It's incredible for any of us. But as I was driving away at the airport, you know what happened to me today? And I shared it with a couple of my friends from the West Side Men's Group that were at my house today. I was driving away from the airport, and you know what the disease said to me today? You know what that little guy in me said to me? Remember when? You know, I hadn't thought about drinking in a long time. I had not thought about drinking in a long time. That's the God's honest truth. You know what my disease told me today? Remember last time you drove your wife to the airport at this time, Steve? Now, it had spoken a different accent today, thank God. Because I'm a new creation right now. So it had a different accent. It almost had like kind of like a Cuban accent. So I'm not really, it wasn't me. It kind of was like, you know where we're going now, aren't you? And I was like, you know, get behind me. So I knew it wasn't me, because usually when I'm talking, it's like a New York accent. So when I think I'm hearing messages from God and I know it's in a New York accent, I know it's not. But today that disease said to me, remember when? And I had this wonderful prayer that was shared with me when I was in treatment 9 years ago, and I've been using it ever since. And I had to use it today. You know, it's funny. I thought I was over that. I thought I was over having to go to the go-to prayer. Because I thought that after having 9 years of doing what I do and running meetings and going to meetings and be going around town with Owen and really turning it over to God every single day, I had thought that I would have been over the enemy telling me that I would get high again. But I'm never going to be over it. And you know what? I guess that's what alcoholism is all about. Every day is a daily surrender. And I gave him the prayer. I gave him the prayer that's always helped me. And I said, God, please remove this bad thought from me. I'm so glad you're with me today. I know you got a little nervous on that, but I wasn't going to give you this. That's the prayer right there. God, please remove this bad thought from me. I'm so glad you're with me today. You see, there was this man that was in my life. It was another sponsor that I had out in California. And he was this guy, and he said to me one time, he took me outside and he said, listen to me, I'm going to tell you a prayer that gets us through everything. Now, I had never been introduced to any really elaborate prayers, but I knew that he had taught in yeshiva. He taught in Jewish school, so I thought he was going to bring out this incredible prayer from the Torah, you know, maybe like unravel it at the edges. You know, it was going to be one of these things hand down from generations. He was going to have the tassels on, maybe a little hat, and he was going to bring it out, and he was going to say, we can only do this at a certain time, and he was going to turn to a certain way, and he was going to unravel it, and he was going to start off in Hebrew. And instead, he just looks at me and he goes, repeat after me. And I go, okay. And he's like, this is the secret to get you out of it all. And I said, okay. He said, ready? And I said, yes. He said, God. I said, God. I'm expecting it all to just come in. Bring it on. Bring it on. Please remove this bad thought from me. I'm so glad you're with me today. Okay, I said that, I was waiting for it. You can bring their next. That's it. What do you mean that's it? There's no secret hand, there's nothing. God, please remove this bad thought from me. I'm so glad you're with me today. Opens up the channel for a guy like me that's in a situation like I was this morning when I need to get there fast. And I need to open up the channel because my mind is now taken over and I have all these bad thoughts that are flooding in and I need to open up that flood to a different place. And I need to open it up to God. And I don't need any fancy prayers. I don't need anything coming at me in a biblical way. I need something to get me there and I need something to block what's going on, because if it's me against the bad thoughts, I can't do it. But me and God against the bad thoughts, I can. So this morning, I use that prayer. And I arrive at the house and everything's fine. And I just thought to myself, how amazing, Dan, that God has given us another shot at our lives once again. That from what we were doing to where we're at tonight, if you have one day in here today, you're off the hook. Yes. There's a whole set of people that are out there. One of that is very, very heavy on my heart tonight. There's a whole set of people that are out there that aren't in here tonight. So even if you have one day, or even if you're in the meeting here for the first time, you're already off the hook, because there's a whole set of people that would never even step into this room tonight. The majority of people that need this program wouldn't even step in that room tonight. And yet we're here. We're already in the winner's circle. We've already taken our spot. We've already gotten our seat. We don't have to wait to get in. We're already in. I don't know about you, but by the time I got to the first step, I was so mangled and beaten and brutally turned around that when they said, would you admit complete defeat? Now this time around? Absolutely. Because the thing that I want to share about you over the weeks to come is I became a big book alcoholic. You know what that means? I drank that little shot of Japanese rice wine, and I became thirsty. Now, I don't know, I'm not saying that anyone needs to go this route, but somehow God must have known that I needed to actually feel like I was an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, and he actually gave me some irrefutable evidence that I'm an alcoholic. Because if you want to know how I actually started drinking after that Japanese rice wine, because I didn't want my wife to know, if you want to know if I really am an alcoholic, I started drinking near beer. Well, that wasn't the funny part of the story. I started drinking near beer so that my wife would know I was drinking, and I was pouring vanilla extract into the near beer. Now let me tell you something. I had 6 years of sobriety. I can afford any type of liquor there was at the time. I could have been ordering Chivas Blue Label, whatever that stuff is. I was drinking near beer with vanilla extract. That's right. Wendy went like this. Don't knock it till you try it, girl. Let me tell you, when you haven't had alcohol in your system for 8 years, it packs a punch. It's disgusting. That's totally disgusting. But that's where I turned. That's where I went to. See, I thought I was this mahogany fine wine type of guy drinking. It turns out I'm near beer vanilla extract type of guy. You see, my alcoholism has no boundaries on where I'm going to be drinking. It doesn't, let me tell you something. One drink, I don't know where I'm going to end up. I never took one of anything and knew what the results was. There was plenty of times where I did take one. I want you to hear something if you're here in Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. There's plenty of times that I took one. But there's never been a time that I took one that I knew what the outcome of that one was going to be. Never one time. Sometimes I was Happy Steve. Other times I was Buy You a Beer Steve. Other times I was Hit You in the Neck Steve. And you never knew what you were going to get. And I never knew what I'm going to get any time that I would take one. And most of the time, I'm sure you guys know that one led to however many, and then of course the substances would change during the night, and then the drinks wouldn't be enough in that one bar, and we'd have to go to another bar, and it would continue and continue and continue, and then you'd have to hear about an after-hour bar, and then you wind up in Chicago. You understand how the story goes. And then always, the same result of the story is me calling my wife, and hearing my wife cry on the other end of the line, "Where are you? Not again." I say, "Sweetheart, this time it'll be different. Next time it'll be different. I promise. I really mean it this time." I hear her crying. "Baby, where are you?" "I don't know. I'm somewhere and I'll get home." See, my wife didn't sign up for that. My wife married me sober. We had a big AA wedding. My sponsor was there. He gave me away. His wife was there. Not gave me away. You know what I mean. You understand what I mean, you sick bunch of people? I have AA witnesses. It was just an amazing AA witness. My wife signed up for that deal. My wife signed up for the guy that was sober deal. And then 2 years later, I'm calling my wife from different bars around town, different places around town that you wouldn't ask any of your friends to pick you up in, let alone your little wife. "I don't know where I'm at, sweetheart. I'll get home and I promise it'll be different this time." And hearing her cry on the other end. So she's away 3 weeks in Colombia, and she has her birthday there, and September 11th happens. September 11th happens, and if you're from New York, September 11th is a big deal for us. Now, I'm not saying it's not a big deal for the rest of the country. I know it is. But I'm telling you that I had close friends die in the Twin Towers. My sister had her best friend die in the Twin Towers. I had people that I went to school with die in the Twin Towers. So if you're from that area, have a little bit of a tie to what happened there. And my sister calls me from New York and she says, "Do you see what happened? Do you see what happened to the Trade Center?" And my wife is in Columbia and she's trying to get through the lines, and the lines are busy. She gets through. She says, "Sweetheart, is everybody okay in your family? Because my whole family's there. Is everything okay?" And I'm sitting in my garage, in my house, in this coffin that I built with hurricane shutters around in the middle of December in the middle of September. I have hurricane shutters around my house. I built this fortress, and I'm inside the fortress in my garage, which has no windows. And I'm staring at CNN, and she says to me, "Are you okay?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "Do you see what's going on?" And my sister's calling me at the same time, and I said, "So what? I'm in Florida." I said, "So what? I'm in Florida. I'm watching the Twin Towers burn." Had nothing to do with me. Nothing to do with me. I'm in Florida. I'm in my den. My parents, knowing that wasn't like me, my parents knowing me in my sobriety, my parents watching me grow up in the program, knew that I had relapsed. They knew that wasn't like me to say, "So what? I'm in Florida. Let them burn." I didn't even understand what I was saying. I thought I was watching like a movie, like The Towering Inferno. I'm like, this is a good movie. I had bottles of stuff and this and, you know, a whole menagerie of stuff. My sister loses her best friend in the Twin Towers, and my parents leave her there with the funeral, and they get into a car because you can't fly at the time, and they drive down from New York, my 65-year-old parents, and they start kicking the door. And I wouldn't open the door up for anybody else but my parents. And then they opened up the door and they saw the horror show of what I did in the house. And I'm going to leave you with this. My wife came back 3 weeks later. And during those 3 weeks, my wife would take me to see Myron and bring me over to the Chicky group, bring me over to the 11-step group, sit with me during the meeting. And I would be obviously high during the meeting. So just in case you're doing pills in the meetings and you don't think everybody knows, we know. Okay? We know. Slurring is not normal in the program. Somebody just get that out there. All you people that say, "Oh, I'm doing so great, I'm sobering you." No. No. You're not doing great. And the other thing I want you to know is that vodka and spearmint gum still tastes, still smells like vodka and spearmint gum to someone that's sober. So you're not, you know, pulling any wool over anybody's eyes. So I'm inside the meetings, and Myron keeps going to my dad. He doesn't look right. My dad's like, no, because my dad loves me so much. He's like, no, he's doing great. And I'm like, I'm taking pills, but I'm not using the other stuff, so I think I'm sober. You know, I'm not doing the hard stuff, so I'm just taking pills, and somehow I thought that was sober. I really did. I mean, I want to tell you something. In my heart of hearts, because I wasn't doing the other stuff and I was just taking pills, I thought I was sober. I'm slurring in meetings, and I'm going to... And they take me to meeting after meeting after meeting, and my wife calls from the airport in Miami, and she's like, I'm back, I miss you so much, I love you so much. I said, I love you so much, but I'm in the house, and I can't stop what I'm doing. And she says, are you outside? And she's called me from the Miami airport. She says, are you outside? 3 weeks I hadn't seen my wife. To me, it was like 3 minutes. To her, it was like an eternity. 9/11 happened. My parents had come down. They're taking me to meetings. They'd brought me to, they had cleaned my house out 12 times with garbage bags and dumped them into Publix 12 different times. Cleaned my whole house. Cleaned me up. Every night, somehow, I would relapse. Somehow I would relapse. I'd have deliveries made in the middle of the night. My parents would be sleeping. My wife calls me from the airport. She's like, sweetheart, I'm home. You outside? And I said, yes, sweetheart, I'm outside. She's like, all right, well, I'm in the American Airlines. And I go, okay, I'll be right in. I'm in Hollywood in the house. I can't stop what I'm doing. I want to stop what I'm doing, but I can't stop what I'm doing. I want to be able to put the stuff down, but I can't stop. And so she calls me back 20 minutes later, and she's like, sweetheart, where are you? I'm like, I'm right outside. And I want to stop, but I can't stop. And she calls my parents, and my dad goes down and picks her up. And I go into Miami, and I get lost for a week. And my wife's standing there with her bags, all 110 pounds of her, looking to see the husband that she married. Hoping that it was all a nightmare, that she didn't believe that it actually came true. She's standing with the bags, and no one goes to pick her up. And she's standing there for 3 hours. Now, over the weeks, I'm going to tell you how I've made amends to her during the years and how the steps have rebuilt my family's relationships, my relationship with my parents, the relationship with my wife, and introduced me to my relationship with my God. But I want to tell you that it all starts in the surrender. Because if I was in the program today and I was thinking that I could just take one, if I could still just take one, that my sobriety would be precarious at best, which means it would hold no water in a real storm. Because brothers and sisters, well, let me tell you something. The storms are coming. It's not like you get into sobriety and all of a sudden life is, whoo, right, John Platt? He's like, whoo. You're going to have whoo, and they're going to have ah, and they're going to have a lot of ah, and then some whoo. But the storms are coming. And if you haven't put your house on rock, when it comes, you're going to get washed away. And there's been some storms that have happened over the last 9 years that I'm going to share about with you in the weeks to come. You're going to say, man, how did he do it? Let me tell you how I didn't do it. He did it. But it only happened because I admitted complete defeat, and I did it today again. I did it today. I could have been in the car like, yo, the enemy was telling me, yo, let's get high, and I'd be like, yo, pfft. But I didn't do that. I called upon the power of God. I said, please remove this bad thought from me. I'm so glad you're with me today because I don't ever want to think that I'm more powerful than the disease of alcoholism. If you're here for the first time, you're off the hook. If you're coming back, welcome back. And if you've been here for forever, well, I hope I get to see you next week. Thanks for letting me know. Well, listen, I got him speaking every single day this week. The moment he landed, he spoke at the Cleveland House. Today he spoke at Bark.